There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad that you can join us for some classic cardboard conversation. And we've got a little bit of colonial classic cardboard this week. Yes, it's one of those sets that you've always known about, but you may not have really invested any time or thought or money in it. But it is a very wise investment because it is a very unique set, and it was only produced in 2 years. Now, there are a couple of different versions of it. You've got the standard set and the Tiffany set, which was the premium subset that Topps was pushing around in the late 1980s. We are talking about Topps UK Minis, and we're looking specifically at the 1988 set. That's the one that I purchased recently. And I've got a fun backstory about finding the set and, you know, receiving it in the mail and getting all excited about it. It was kind of like a kitten, you know, receiving this cute little kitten. You're like, oh, look at this. It's so tiny. And yeah, even the whole family enjoyed me actually opening that package of baseball cards. And it's a neat set. And Topps made it for all the right reasons, not just for education, but also for economics. But like many things that formulate in America, and I guess you could stretch it out to just North America in general, even if you have the right reasons, sometimes they just don't translate properly in Europe. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Also, we'll discuss why I don't like the name UK Minis. That's not the technical name of the set. That's the set that's, the name of the set that's kind of been floating around. Hobbyists have been calling it that for over 30 years now. But I have a bone to pick with the name UK Minis. And I got into the reasons why during our video break. So if you want to watch the video break from yesterday, it's on our YouTube channel. And it's Wax Ecstatic 1988 Topps UK Minis. Yes, even though I don't like the name, I still call it UK Minis, so you can find it quickly. And, we just open up the set and take a look at it. And I get into a little bit of the reason why I don't like the Topps UK Minis name. And there's a good reason for it. Now, I don't know if the accepted nickname will ever change, because for most people, they don't care. But because of my family's heritage, I am a little bit miffed at the UK Mini name. And it should probably be referred more to as Topps American Baseball Cards. The Topps American set is probably what it should be called, but it is just latched on to the UK Mini nickname for many, many years. So we're going to have some fun with that. We'll also pick four players from the Topps UK Mini set from 1988. A few that, of course, you already know about, because the UK Mini set was a set of basically current stars in 1988. So you've got some pretty big names like Nolan Ryan and Mike Schmidt and Gary Carter in there. But we picked a few names that kind of fell through the cracks over the years, maybe didn't quite get the publicity that they should have. But there is one player in particular who did get the publicity, a lot of negative publicity. And I actually chose him from the handful of cards I pulled out of the box, because he was one of the cards that was selected in a pack of 1986 Topps cards by author Brad Blukjan. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is what we call a segue in the broadcasting business. Let's take a look ahead to some of the topics we're going to discuss in future episodes of Wax Ecstatic. My plan is for the program on July 17th, so that's our next show, should feature an interview with Brad Blukjan. We are setting that up. I have just completed reading the Wax Pack book, and I highly recommend it. I recommended it a lot in our last show. I had only read maybe 4 or 5 chapters at that point in time and already liked it, but having completed it, I give it 2 thumbs up. And it is, like many other baseball card books, it is more than just baseball cards or baseball. If you've ever read, certainly Wax Pack Gods is one of the many ones. Dave Jameson's Mint Condition, it's a similar story too. While Dave covers more of the history of baseball cards, you know, there's personal stories woven in there, and Brad does a great job with that with the Wax Pack book. And a lot of storylines that kind of run through it, not only Brad's personal life and his personal attempt to reach out to these players that are in the Wax Pack of 1986 Tops, but also stories of baseball, fatherhood, the importance of a father figure in one's life. And we'll get into all of that, including the struggle that Brad had getting the damn thing published. We will discuss that in our upcoming interview. Now, as for a pack of cards to open up around that interview, of course, the easy answer is, well, 86 Tops. And yeah, the thing is, though, is that we have recently done a lot of 86 Tops. We did 86 Tops originally the week before we talked to Brad Blukjan the first time around in the early stages of this podcast. We're talking almost 4 years ago. And, you know, we did an 86 Tops Rack Pack show not that long ago. I want to say, probably like 4 or 5 months ago. So I may return. I may just track down an 86 Tops pack and it'll open it up just for the hell of it, just because it fits in perfectly with the topic. Or I may just track down some other packs of cards that I think are relevant to the conversation. So don't know what cards will accompany the conversation with Brad Blukjan, but we'll try to make it worth your while. Now, also I have on the whiteboard here a look at 1975 Tops. I mentioned this in last week's episode, where a recent card donation from one of our listeners featuring quite a few 75 Tops cards sparked me to actually set aside a 660 count box, and I went, well, I guess I'll put this one together too. So I now actually have a little bit of baseball card set ADHD. Has this happened to you, where you just have all of these unfinished sets that you're building and you just have too many? You can't quite focus on them. And I finally had to discipline myself and just go, okay, Matt, you've got, you know, a couple from the late 70s here you're working on. You've got a whole bunch in the early 80s. You just completed a bunch of junk wax sets. Pick one. let's focus on one, maybe two, and let's try to, you know, finish these up before we move on to, you know, the rest of them. So I have put my focus and dedication to the 75 and 77 top sets. 77 tops I'm working on because that's my birth year. So I'll be tracking those down, and I'm not too concerned about condition of cards, because trying to get an impeccably PSA 10 version of 75 tops is damn near impossible, and certainly far above what is in my checking account right now. So I'm manufacturing a 75 tops set, buying up a few lots here and there. And as I mentioned in the last show, I'm trying to track down a 75 tops pack. They've been a little elusive. They are quite common on eBay, but getting one for a decent price, sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes you happen to hop into one of these auctions and you run away with a pack of 75 tops. And we're talking regular, not minis. But sometimes you're able to run away with a pack of 75 tops for a winning bid of like $35. More often than not, and this has been the case of late, you know, it's up actually where it should be, you know, in the $60 to $80 range. And it should be up there, because if this is a truly unopened pack of 1975 tops, you could get a George Brett rookie, you can get a Robin Yount rookie, you can get a Gary Carter rookie, you can get a lot of early career cards from Carlton Fisk and Mike Schmidt and all the stars from the late 1960s and early 70s. So there is some value in this. So I'm not surprised that it's a little bit out of my reach right now, but I am trying to get a 75 tops pack. I hope I can get it. You know, this show would probably fall, July 31st. So hopefully sometime within the next couple of weeks, I can get one. We can open it together, talk about the cards inside, and have some fun, just like we did with the 74 Tops pack a few months ago. Now, in the event I can't track down a 75 Tops pack, The good thing is, with all of these lots that I've been buying, these little lots of 50 and 60 cards recently, I'm able to not only add to the set that I'm building, but I'm also able to replace some of the lower grade cards with the dupes that I have. So I do have a handful of 75 Topps cards just kind of laying around. I even gave some to my son. You know, if I had three or four copies of duplicates, of course, I gave the mandatory donation to Commons for Kids, but the extras I gave to my son. So I may even just grab that stack of cards, and one way or the other, we'll take a look at a handful of 75 Topps cards. One of the legendary sets of the 1970s, and to steal a phrase from the Hooters restaurant chain, they are delightfully tacky. That is the best way I can describe 75 Topps. It is something that, by normal descriptions, they're just hideous, and they are definitely representative of everything that 1975 represents, and we'll get into that in a little more detail when that show happens. But the amazing thing about these 75 Topps cards is that even though there is a hideous factor to it, and you may have to shield your eyes when looking at some of the color combinations that are on these cards, it is still a landmark set, not only because of those big rookie cards and those early career cards for star players, but, you know, it's just because of its gaudy design that people remember it so well. And it has been replicated numerous times in Topps archives and other, you know, rip-off sets that just like to, you know, pull throwback designs together. But when you look at the original, it is a sight to behold. And it is hard to get, like I said, in mint condition, not only because of the colors, but the cardboard, the centering is the big issue. Boy, I've seen some comically way off-center cards in these 75 Topps lots that I've been combing through. So we'll talk 75 Topps a little later on in the summer. And then, yes, I promised you, after teasing you for a few weeks, we're going to do, I don't know if it'll be right after the 75 Topps show. This is just one of those topics that I'm going to put on the board and we'll eventually get to it. But I think it'll be a fun set to look at. And as I have teased, it is a set that is not very well liked. It is quite plentiful, but it is not well liked by a lot of collectors. And we had all sorts of guesses. A lot of people were wondering, well, what exactly is this? And while some people came very, very, very close, I do have to say we had one listener who sent me an email who hit the nail on the head. Mark Zenkovich, one of our listeners in the great state of Tennessee, emailed me not that long ago and said, well, I'll take a stab at it. Is it the 1982 Topps Kmart 20th Anniversary MVP set? Give that man a cigar. Yes, it is the set that a lot of collectors hate. I think a lot of it has to do with the stigma attached to the Kmart brand, which even in the early to mid 80s had already changed to, you know, cheap and kitschy. You know, Kmart was a retail leader for many years in the 60s and 70s. But by the 80s, it kind of came as a cheap urban strip mall store, which eventually would get overpowered by Walmart. And the Kmart brand is almost officially dead, I believe, now. It is part of, it got gobbled up by Sears. So you had two struggling chains coming together a few years ago, and Sears is going belly up. So I think the Kmart brand is officially dead. But the Kmart set from 1982, featuring the Topps MVP cards, which also tied into Kmart's 20th anniversary, it's quite the set to behold, because as much as collectors hate it, because of the connection to the kind of cheap feel that Kmart had, and also because these sets were so mass-produced and really don't carry much value. In fact, the cardboard itself is probably more valuable than the retail value of the set. A lot of collectors just don't like these, and because they were so mass produced, there's still plenty of them out there. But my argument Not that you should invest heavily in the 82 Topps Kmart MVP set, but my argument as to why we're going to take a look at it, other than the fact that it is in many ways the Manos Hands of Fate set in the baseball card industry, it still deserves a tip of the cap because I found it to be a very educational piece, certainly in my life, and I think others will agree with me, in informing you who the MVPs of both the American League and National League were from 1962 to 1981. And you have to keep in mind, if you're looking at these cards through the eyes of a young child, not even in 1982, you know, fast forward, say, 1989, 1990, kind of like I was. This is the days before the internet. You couldn't easily look up pictures of baseball cards from, say, 1965 if you wanted to learn more about an MVP, or, you know, 1974, what have you. You had something like the Kmart set that was a little bit of a handheld history book, if you will. And I think it has some educational value. And there's also some interesting stories behind some of the cards pictured in the set, including the fact that a couple of them never existed in real life. One of them being Mari Wills, 1962. Mari Wills did not have a solo 1962 Topps card, but Topps had to make one in the 1962 design and add it to this Topps Kmart set to help tell the story of the American League and National League MVPs going back to 1962. So there's some unique stories around this set. And even though this is a much derided set, I will give it a little bit of honor in the sense that, again, you know, if you're growing up in the 1980s, pre-internet days, this was a rather helpful and resourceful guide to past MVPs and also past baseball cards. That was one of the thrills of getting the Beckett Baseball Card Monthly magazine pre-internet days, because when you looked at the listings of all the cards, they had a picture of each card above the name of the brand and the year it was produced. So if you didn't have a 1965 Topps card in your possession, then through Beckett Baseball Card Monthly, or again in the case of a Topps Kmart 20th anniversary set, you at least could see up close what these cards looked like. And that was part of the education of the hobby. Not only did I learn that Zolio Versailles was the American League MVP in 1965, now I could see what the card looked like, and I could kind of sort of hold one in my hand. But eventually I would, you know, be old enough to go to card shows and card shops and buy them on my own. And of course, as the internet evolved, you had, you know, eBay and everything else to where these are pretty plentiful. But, you know, back in the day, this was pretty much your only portal into a history of the game and the history of the players as well. So that is my excuse to take a deeper look at this Kmart set. It's a very unpopular set for the reasons I told before, and I'll get into some when we do this show. A little bit of retail history too, because I think that the story of Kmart's demise is fascinating. Just how Walmart totally beat Kmart at its own game. These are two stores that, if I remember correctly, actually opened in the same year. They both opened in 1962. And Walmart had the technical and big picture know-how to beat Kmart at its game. And, you know, certainly Walmart has its challenges today with Amazon and other competitors. But, you know, Walmart's still standing all these years later, and Kmart is in the ash heap with the other retail giants such as Sears, and there'll be plenty more given the economy that we're in right now. So that's a look ahead to some of the upcoming shows that we're going to do. Also a reminder to share your thoughts about any shows that we do, or any sets, or any players we talk about with our Twitter handle at Wax and Gum Stains. It is open 24/7. A quick comment, and in fact, it involves 1975 Topps. from Brian Krause, who sends us a screenshot of the 75 Topps Rudy Mioli card. Mioli was a weak hitting shortstop for the California Angels back in the mid-70s, and his 75 Topps card does not help his cause, as it's a quote-unquote action shot of him in spring training clearly popping up straight over home plate. And Brian mentions that he is channeling his inner Willie Mays Hayes, and there's no doubt about that. There were some rather unflattering action cards, as Topps was trying in vain to feature more action shots in their sets in the early 1970s. But Mioli's may be the epitome of sometimes no action is the best action, because Mioli does not look very good at all popping this ball straight up into the air in spring training. And to also add some insult to injury, the Angels uniform that he's wearing in this picture, it features the lowercase a, and the Angels wore that uniform only in the 72 and 73 seasons. Now, in 72, they also had the lowercase a and halo on the cap. In 73, they changed it to the big A with the halo, but they kept the little a on the uniform. So when they were assembling the photos for 75 Topps, probably in the fall of 1974, and they decided for some strange reason to include Mioli in the set, the best that the Topps editors could do was find this 2 to 3 year old photograph of Mioli popping straight up at home plate at spring training. So a little bit of ecstasy and agony of looking at that. So that ties in nicely with our conversation of 75 Topps in a couple of weeks, but also just a fun conversation piece there. And we always invite that at Wax and Gum Stains. Don't forget too, despite the economic hard times, we do welcome any donations, be it cash or cardboard. If it's cardboard, please reach out to me first. Don't just dump thousands of cards on my doorstep. You can reach out to me either via Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, or through my email at mattsalmonsays, it's all one word, and says is S-E-Z, at gmail.com, and we can talk back and forth about the donations you want to make. Cash donations, as always, go straight to the program, as we will take that money and send it to Audio Boom to keep our broadcast up and running on Audio Boom and all of the RSS feeds that send it out to Apple Podcast and iHeartRadio and all the others that are out there. The money that you send our way is put to good use in purchasing the products that we discuss. So while I'm on the hunt for 75 Topps packs, every cash donation helps track down those particular items. And also, your donations go to good hands as well, in the forms of duplicates, extras, or the material that we use in the show but don't necessarily want to keep around. We will donate it to Commons for Kids, who do a great job in collecting not just baseball cards, but sports and non-sports cards. And they are certainly looking for anything from current stuff to older stuff. As long as it's in halfway decent shape, they will take it. They will donate it to kids who are just looking for something positive in their lives. And there's a whole lot of adversity going on in the world today. So by being able to donate these cards, connecting kids to the game of baseball, connecting kids to the hobby, and in many cases, just giving them a positive distraction from the crap that they're dealing with today, that is always a good mission. So we've recently sent some cards out to Commons for Kids. We've got some more on the way. So know that any penny that you send our way via our PayPal site, paypal.me/waxecstatic, goes to not only keeping the program up and running, keeping the archives free and available for download, but also in purchasing products and passing along a lot of these products to kids in need. Last but not least, you know, I kind of got on my soapbox about coronavirus. I live in Florida, where it is just running rampant right now. Thankfully, my family is safe. My extended family is safe. But this is something that is going to be running its course, sadly. And I've been a very, very vocal person about this stunning lack of leadership, not only in situations like in Florida with our dimbulb governor, Ron DeSantis, but also all the way up to the White House and Congress. And I'm very, very angry at how this has all been handled, amongst other things that are going on in this country. But I don't want to get on the soapbox. I want to get to Topps UK Minis. And I just want to conclude that thought with just the simple message that I'm going to continue repeating. Wash your hands, wear your masks, social distance, and stay safe. If not because you care about others, because you care for yourself. If not because you don't care for others or you don't care for yourself, if you want to watch football this fall, people, wash your hands, wear your mask, social distance. I mean, we've got to know our audience. We've got to talk to this nation. You want to watch football this fall, wash your hands, wear your mask, social distance. You don't need that bucket of Bud Lights at Applebee's in this situation. Go to the store with your mask on, buy your Bud Lights, go home, stick it in a bucket of ice, and stay healthy and, you know, drink crappy beer. But please, 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 because we're not going to get any guidance or leadership at any level of government at this stage in time. We're all in this together, but we're all by ourselves, sadly. Wash your hands, wear your mask, social distance. If you don't like that information, if you don't like that message, if you don't like me harping at the current leadership that is in this position to do something but has chosen not to in many cases, unfollow Wax and Gum Stains, don't listen to the podcast anymore, and kiss my ass. Because somebody's got to say something to, you know, get the right message across. And if I have to resort to selfish terms to get people to do the right thing, then so be it. And if you don't like it, then, you know, follow the previous advice and pucker up. All right, let's take a look at the 88 Topps UK mini set. And before I get on the soapbox about the Topps UK Mini name, I do want to talk briefly about the story behind what made Topps UK Minis even happen. And it all happens, of course, in the late 1980s as the baseball card hobby is turning into an industry and it is exploding. Topps not only having to deal with Fleer and Donruss and soon Score stateside, but of course in 1988, you've got the precipice of Upper Deck coming around, and Topps will even unleash Bowman once again in 1989. And things are about to just get fat and bloated in the baseball card industry over the next few years. But still, the sky was the limit. If you start thinking about, say, 1986, 1987, you know, going into the production of the UK mini sets, or like I said, the official name is Topps American Baseball. So let's go back to 1987, shall we? Think about the world in 1987. If you're old enough to remember, it was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. And you had seen over years, the Soviet Union was starting to not only open up a little bit, but crumble from the inside out. You had a lot of former Soviet republics that were breaking away from the Soviet Union and declaring independence. You had a lot of nations in especially Eastern Europe declaring independence and breaking away from Russian communism, namely Poland. Also, of course, Czechoslovakia was, breaking away from Soviet rule. And, you know, really the bellwether, of course, was Germany. When the Berlin Wall fell in late 1989 and Germany became reunified for the first time since World War II, all of a sudden Europe became a destination for everybody. It was the beacon of independence. And it was just such a shocking independence movement, because if you were born and raised anytime between 1945 and 1989, you were told that Eastern Europe was just this den of communism and socialism, and it was under the oppressive thumb or the lurking shadow of the Russians. And, of course, you had the Cold War going on, and any day now the Russians could blow us up or we could blow them up. And it was especially tense in the 1980s. I think as children, you weren't aware of the tension. You knew about it. You heard about it. You know, you saw Ronald Reagan stand up there and go, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And, you know, you heard about the missile reduction treaties and stuff like that, but I don't think you really accept the tension that had been bubbling up and was starting to bubble over in several instances in the early to mid 80s. Of course, now as an adult, we totally realize the tension, and we understand now why mom and dad used to drink a lot when the kids went to bed. But, you know, in the 1980s, as the Cold War is starting to wind down, and Europe, especially Eastern Europe, is looking like this, you know, beacon of new hope in the world, then it also turned out to be a beacon of commerce. That's right. You get communism out of the way, and here comes capitalism, baby. And Topps rightfully saw Europe as an emerging market. And not just, you know, Soviet bloc Eastern Europe, but in particular, as the case is with the American baseball card set, all of Europe. This, of course, the early days of the European Union coming together. This is the early days of just this general idea that these European countries, not just Germany and Czechoslovakia and Poland, but Russia, Spain, England, you know, the United Kingdom, Ireland, Portugal, all of these nations, France, you know, that you know, they've been still kind of wounded from the effects of World War II. Well, finally, 40 plus years later, they're starting to emerge from that, and they're starting to kind of, you know, take charge of everything. So it was a pretty amazing time and an amazing opportunity for a company like Topps to try to expand their product and sell overseas. And Topps was far from the first company to think of this. You know, I can think of, you know, Coca-Cola and the Walt Disney Company and you name it, any big business. As things are changing in Europe in the 1980s, every big business was thinking of how to set up shop over there. So Topps decides that Europe is a wise place to expand, and in the late 1980s, it actually was. So in 1988, they create the Topps American Baseball Card Set, and it is very similar to the Topps Minis cards that were being sold stateside. And as we've discussed before, Topps had experimented with mini cards back in 1975 with the mini version of the base set. And the reason why they did that was to experiment with the, you know, it was kind of a trial balloon. Would collectors accept smaller cards, all in the name of saving money? You know, this was the mid-70s. America was in an incredible recession at this point in time, amongst other problems it was having. And Topps was looking to cut corners, quite literally, by cutting the size of cards. And even though Topps never fully went to a miniature set after 1975, it was something that kind of came off as a novelty in the much more economically fruitful days of the mid to 1980s. So in America, you could buy Topps mini cards. It was just kind of a kitschy little side set, if you will. So Topps basically took the American version and decided to make a European version, but with some notable changes. First of all, the Topps American baseball sets of 1988 and 1989, the only 2 years that they put these together, were loaded with stars. The set was 88 cards total, and that includes one checklist, so 87 player cards. Why 88 cards? Well, it's easy to print up 88 cards on one sheet and cut them up. You have a nice equal distribution. You have, no short prints, no double prints. And the UK minis, as they're known, were available in pack form with bubblegum or in the form that I got, which is, of course, the complete set. Just comes in this nice little tiny little box. And the fronts of the cards feature action color photos of the players, but also nice big logos so you know the name of the team. You flip the card over and the back is really unique. The stats, which Topps had since 1971 prided itself on complete major and minor league stats if space provided. Well, on the UK minis, you've got one line for 1987 and one line for a career. Well, what was to be made of the rest of the space on the card? Well, for one thing, if you had a player, say, Mike Schmidt, who'd been playing since the early 70s, well, on these much smaller size cards, you'd need a magnifying glass to look at the complete major league statistics of Mike Schmidt. you know, the same for Nolan Ryan or, you know, any other player who was still chugging along, you know, at that pace, you know, who'd been playing around since, you know, the mid-70s in some cases, George Brett, Robin Yount, for example. So, you know, you had to kind of limit it to one line. But Topps also utilized the backs of these cards to educate fans overseas on the game of American baseball. So you not only had the personal information and a facsimile autograph of the player in one corner, but you had a baseball rule. So, for example, when you flip over the back of the Tony Gwynn card, there is a definition of a bunt. Now, we all know what a bunt is, but if you're living in England and you only have a casual knowing of what baseball is, despite its many roots in the game of cricket, you know, what's a bunt? You know, bunt just sounds, you know, well, like a cake. So you have a definition of a standard play in baseball. And what I also like what Topps did was in some cases it would take the definition of a statistic or a definition of a play and tie it into that player's card. So as we discovered while we were going through the set, we found the Steve Bedrosian card. So Bedrosian's informational tidbit was about the G statistic, which it says, you know, is representative of the number of games played or games pitched in the case of a pitcher. And it says Steve Bedrosian pitched in 65 games in 1987. So it was a very unique way of educating on the basics of baseball, the basics of baseball stats, and sometimes tying it into the player that you were looking at, which I thought was ingenious. So Topps is not only looking to make some money selling these cards overseas, but also educating the fans, tying it into some of the biggest names in baseball at that time, and producing a really sharp set. Now, if the white card stock wasn't impressive enough for you with the base set, you could buy a Tiffany version of the set as well, which featured even thicker card stock, glossier coatings, something that Topps had been doing with the base sets throughout the mid to late 80s. So there were a couple different versions. Couple different ways you got it. You could either buy the entire set in a little box, or you can buy it through packs if you wanted the bubble gum and wanted the experience of opening up packs of baseball cards. So there were a lot of great reasons for the creation of the Topps UK mini sets or the Topps American baseball card sets. So why didn't it last? Well, even though it is a revenue stream, an additional revenue stream, you're only going to get so much revenue from a sport that, while it's easy to follow, it doesn't necessarily translate well in another country. And again, despite the roots of baseball being connected to cricket, which is very popular in Europe and throughout parts of Northern Africa, most people just didn't really care for baseball. You know, unless you were a transplanted American, maybe you were serving in the armed forces. Other than that, you just didn't give two hoots about baseball. So there was a new audience for Topps to sell to, but it was kind of a reluctant audience. And even though a lot of the, you know, consumerism that was creeping into Europe in the late 80s and early 90s, even though it was very Balky Bartokomus, God bless the USA type stuff, and people were buying their Jordache jeans and all sorts of other US gadgets because they wanted to be so much like the United States, the baseball cards just didn't quite catch on because baseball just couldn't quite catch on throughout Europe. And of course, there are still, you know, at this point in time, over 200 years after America declared its independence from Great Britain, the Brits are still kind of laughing at baseball being America's pastime. Oh, that's the colonist game. Well, we shan't spend some more time with that. So even though it was a new revenue stream, it just wasn't a very enthusiastic one. And there were some limitations to sending all of these cards overseas and trying to, you know, garnish some interest there. And I should correct myself. It's not like Topps made them here and sent them overseas. It's just putting in the money to have them produced overseas very quickly, Topps discovered that this just wasn't really a good money-making effort. Topps needed to direct its efforts stateside to the increased competition from Upper Deck and the increased competition from everybody and the steerage towards premium sets in 1991 and moving forward. So the Topps American Baseball sets of 1988 and 89, great ideas, not only for economic reasons, but also for educational reasons and for growing the hobby overseas, but it just felt flat. And, you know, Topps American Baseball cards are not the only things that just didn't translate well in Europe. Do you remember the World League of American Football? You know, that was one of the big things, the World League of American Football in the early 1990s. Yeah, sure, you had some, you know, USFL-like markets like Orlando and Memphis, you know, Montreal, you know, hosting football teams, but they would put teams in Barcelona and London and in Germany. And, you know, it's just American football on a regular basis just didn't work. And I think what you're seeing professional sports teams are learning is that while you're always teasing, hey, maybe one day we'll have a team based here, it's just a lot of American sports just don't grab on to the general public in Europe. Of course, soccer is the big sport over there. English Premier League, also, you know, all the different world leagues that play around there. You know, that's the sport that really grips the general public. So football hasn't been able to do it, even though the NFL still puts on a couple games in London every year. Baseball doesn't do it, as evidenced even in the baseball cards that were used over there. And, you know, basketball's tied mostly to China. Hockey goes to Europe every now and then, but again, it's kind of one-offs. You know, they'll do a series in Prague or, you know, a series in Stockholm just because you have a lot of players that come there and they, you know, come over to North America to play in the NHL. So Topps American Baseball cards, not the only thing to falter in Europe. And it's just because you've got a very unique audience that's there. Yes, there is a revenue stream, but I think as sports teams and sports leagues are learning, and Topps certainly found out, there's revenue there, but not in terms of having a consistent product there all the time. It's just stopping by, you know, passing jail, you know, collecting $200, if you will, to use a Monopoly term. Now you may be wondering, okay, what is my beef with the name Topps UK Minis? And I didn't realize this until I turned the package over when I received it. And by the way, the day that it came to my house, it was like Christmas morning. I open up the package and I go, oh, wow, look at this. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny little box. It's like 2 inches tall and 3 inches, you know, lengthwise, about an inch deep. And my wife and my son were there when I opened that up. And even they were just like, wow, those are so tiny. Oh, and so cute. It's just this little dinky little box with 88 baseball cards in it. And as I'm, you know, kind of looking over the box, I flip it over, and on the bottom, I see that it says that these were produced by the Topps company in the Republic of Ireland. And in fact, they had a factory that printed these cards up in County Cork, or as the locals call it, Cork. And that really raised an eyebrow to me, because I've got a lot of my family heritage, a lot of my lineage comes from the Republic of Ireland. My great-grandfather emigrated from Ireland to Philadelphia, left the port of Cove, the same port that the Titanic and Lusitania, we talk about bad luck there, both of those ships sailed from. And in 1905, my great-grandfather left Cove along with several family members and emigrated to Philadelphia, eventually a few years later moving to Brooklyn. And, you know, there's a lot of my family history that's in Ireland, and because of that, certainly have studied up on Ireland. My wife and I, very fortunate to travel to Ireland back in the summer of 2008. Of course, this was pre-kids, you know, when we had the time and money and sanity to do that. But also, you know, the kids are getting old enough, and as soon as, you know, our nation figures out how the hell to handle coronavirus and we can actually travel to Europe again, you know, at some point in time, we're going to take the kids there again. It's a beautiful place, charming people, and, you know, very heavily, you know, tied to the tourism industry. But if you ever get the chance to go to Ireland, absolutely do it. And, you know, we flew into Dublin. We did Dublin for, I think, 3 days. We did Cork for 3 days. And then we did the Shannon, you know, rural area, Clare and Ennis, you know, all around there for the last 3 or 4 days. And it's not that we knew this by design when we came up with our travel plans, but by chance we happened to go from the most cosmopolitan city, relaxed a little more in Cork, to the rural, laid-back, rolling hills of Ireland in the western portion of the country. And it was just neat to kind of, you know, land in Dublin, and then over time you're just kind of slowing down, scaling down, and simplifying things. It was absolutely beautiful. But, you know, knowing the history of the Republic of Ireland, I am here to inform you that the Republic of Ireland, the nation that holds such wonderful cities as Dublin and Cork and the Shannon region and Galway Bay and Limerick and Tipperary and all those regions that you've probably sung about at some Irish pub on or about March 17th, is not part of the UK and has not been part of the UK for a century now. The UK, if you don't know, is short for United Kingdom. And the United Kingdom, as of today, is the nation of Great Britain, Northern Ireland, so there are some counties in the north that are part of the United Kingdom still, and several smaller nations and island nations. That is the United Kingdom. The Republic of Ireland is not the United Kingdom. Once upon a time, it was. But, as I put my history teacher hat on, there has been a lot of blood shed over the past few centuries with British rule in the Republic of Ireland and the Republic of Ireland's granted dreams to eventually secede from the United Kingdom and become its own nation, which it finally was able to do in the early 1920s. So I do have a bone to pick. You know, there are greater things to be upset about these days. But I just, as somebody with a lot of Irish blood in my family, and by the way, if you trace the name Salmon back, there are British roots there. Sometime during one of the many conquests of the Republic of Ireland, sometime in the Middle Ages, the fishermen who were named the Salmons eventually, moved probably to Cork around there, and eventually lived in Ireland for a few centuries before coming to America. But, as somebody with a lot of Irish blood in my family, I'm not very pleased to have something that was produced in the Republic of Ireland and the wonderful County Cork called a UK product. You know, it's just, that's not right. It just isn't. And I'm trying to think of a contemporary version, and I don't even want to get into North versus South or Confederate states because it's, first of all, it's not right, it's not accurate, but also it's just a dumb fight to have in 2020. But the point is, you know, there's this product that's carrying this name of one thing when it was completely made somewhere else. So moving forward, I refer to this set as the Topps American Baseball set because that's its actual name. Now, it may have found a lot of success in the United Kingdom. It may have found a lot of success in Great Britain. And by the way, no offense to Great Britain or Northern Ireland. Hey, again, when I can travel to Europe again, hopefully sooner than later, I'm going to visit London. I've never been to London. I'd love to visit Britain. I'd love to, visit Northern Ireland and certainly hold no bones against them. But I'm going to call it Topps American Baseball set because that's the name of it. And yes, there is a history lesson here. Don't call something UK when it was proudly made by the hands of people in County Cork. So just kind of keep that in mind. By the way, Cork is just another wonderful place to visit. as I do my duty here, my free publicity for the Republic of Ireland and the Irish Tourism Board. You know, what's also interesting, too, about Cork, and this is typical of the southern counties in Ireland, the southern counties are actually the more rebellious, still are these days. They still have a grudge with a lot of things that happen in the north. They are still, even though Ireland's been pretty much at peace for the last 25 years, they still have some issues with what they call, quote-unquote, the Troubles with the North. And that rebellious feeling is still quite strong in the South. So that even adds a little more gas to the fire, doesn't it? You know, why are you calling something from the rebellious, you know, secessionist Southern Ireland counties? Why are you calling it UK? Boy, that's a poke in the eye, isn't it? One last thing, too. If you do go to Cork, they are the proud producers of Beamish, which is a stout. And while Ireland is much known and much loved for Guinness, and I do love my Guinness, but I've got a dark secret to share with you. Beamish is better. Don't say that too loudly in the north, okay? Especially around Dublin. All right, let's take a look at some of the cards that we pulled from this Topps American Baseball card set. I got to start saying that as opposed to UK minis. But, you know, this is a wonderful set. Before I look at the four players that I randomly chose here, this is a wonderful set and very affordable. The 1988 set that I got, which is in mint condition, by the way, outstanding shape. And you never know because, you know, these are in kind of the flimsy cardboard boxes that the Topps Traded sets used to be included in. And, you know, if you toss those boxes around enough, you were dinging corners left and right on those cards. But these are quite affordable. The one that I got, I think, from eBay was like $10. You know, with shipping, maybe it was 13. I mean, quite affordable. And it is loaded with stars. Remember, basically, this is the, you know, proverbial all-star roster of Major League Baseball from 1988. And you do have a few names on there where you're like, huh? How did this guy get on there? But the majority of them are notable names, quality players, and certainly worthy of dropping $10 or so. To have. And I've got to track down mini card sleeves. I know they make them. I haven't seen them anywhere, but I actually want to, you know, dress these up a little bit, put them in the sleeves and showcase this. This is a very nice set, and I highly recommend if you can track it down to pick them up just for a neat little keepsake that is not only loaded with stars and looks good, but is a representative of the beacon of hope for democracy, freedom, and yes, capitalism in Europe in the late 1980s. All right, as I was saying, I did pick four cards from random. Now, I didn't go through the whole set in the video. I basically just grabbed the top 20 or 30 cards and kind of flipped through them. And I didn't want to go through the names that we know a lot of. There is one exception. But, you know, I tried to avoid the Nolan Ryans and Gary Carters and Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire's because we all know those stories. And I just wanted to pick four names that would kind of hang out there that if you were a baseball fan back then, maybe you forgot about it or maybe you didn't. Maybe this is bringing back some good memories. The one player that you do know of, and this is one that when I saw it, I said, yeah, I got to talk about this guy. And it's all because he was part of the 1986 Topps pack that Brad Blukjan opened and chased down the players for, is Vincent Van Gogh. Yes, Vince Coleman, who was at the top of his game in 1988, but it would all come crashing down. And as you will discover in reading the Wax Pack book, has not really, you know, been reborn. Coleman's life has been you know, kind of a selfish disaster for the last 30 years or so. And he's struggled to kind of recover from it. He's kind of done it partially, like the St. Louis Cardinals have finally reaccepted the prodigal son, excuse me. He is a member of the St. Louis Cardinals Hall of Fame, but even that, as Brad Blukjan mentioned in the book, was elusive up until just a few years ago. So let's talk about Vince Coleman, shall we? Born in 1961 in Jacksonville. He's actually got a very interesting athletic past, as he was a star at William Raines High School, went on to Florida A&M in Tallahassee, and in 1981, He set the all-time single-season stolen base record at Florida A&M with 65 steals in 69 attempts. Not surprisingly, he led the NCAA Division I that season in both total steals and stolen base percentage. Now, Coleman was not only a baseball star, and of course you could see this with his speed on the base paths. He was actually a halfway decent hitter as well, had a .264 batting average in his career. But he was also a football star. Now, normally you would think, oh, a guy like Vince Coleman, you know, well, maybe a quarterback, running back, wide receiver, maybe. No, actually a kicker and a punter. And before you laugh, I'm going to steal a little bit of a joke here from Rich Eisen of NFL Network. Kickers are people too. Punters are people too. And Vince Coleman certainly was. Not only was he a kicking star for Florida A&M, but he also delivered a clutch game-winning field goal to help Florida A&M beat the University of Miami back in 1979. Now, this was the early Howard Schnellenberger days, too. So this was before Miami came roaring back as a powerhouse. In fact, University of Miami was threatening to shut down the football program. It was just so bad. So it's kind of neat that almost one of the final nails in the coffin was a Vince Coleman game-winning field goal in a 16-13 win. Now, also, Coleman's cousin, Greg Coleman, preceded him at Florida A&M, and he was also a kicking star, later with a 12-year NFL career with Cleveland, Minnesota, and Washington. So that's a kind of a neat little lineage story there with the Coleman family. So after his exploits on the football field and baseball, Coleman knew that he was going to be a baseball star, and he was drafted in the 10th round by the St. Louis Cardinals. No surprise, as the Cardinals under Whitey Herzog were building a team that was going to be all about speed and taking advantage of the AstroTurf, not only at Busch Stadium, but which was plentiful in many other stadiums in Major League Baseball at the time. So he gets drafted in 1982, and to no surprise, very quickly moves up in the Cardinals' farm system, makes his major league debut in 1985, where he steals 110 bases. That is third most in a season, first by Ricky Henderson, 130 in 1982, Lou Brock with 118 in 1974. So Vince Coleman makes his presence known, and the Cardinals, of course, charging ahead to another National League pennant. But Coleman would not be a big factor, not only in the final few games of the 85 National League pennant against the Los Angeles Dodgers, but eventually in the World Series against Kansas City, as one of the freakiest injuries happened to Coleman during pregame warmups. He's on the turf at Busch Stadium. He's just stretching his legs and, you know, doing those normal leg stretches that you see guys do out in the field. Well, at the time, they were getting the tarp moved and tested just in case rain were to come over the area. And the automatic tarp actually rolled over Coleman, severely injuring him and knocking him out of the remainder of the playoffs. It caused some major leg injuries to him that, you know, fortunately were short term. But still, you have to wonder, had the Cardinals had Vince Coleman available, would they have prevailed in the 1985 World Series? And would Don Denkinger actually be welcomed into the city of St. Louis after blowing that call at first base in Game 6? So, you know, a lot of what-ifs around that. Of course, the Cardinals fell to the Royals in seven games, and Coleman was the National League Rookie of the Year in 1985, and it seemed like his career was just going to go up from there. But then the personal issues come into play. He clashed with Whitey Herzog quite often, and he also clashed with a lot of other people, including the widow of Jackie Robinson, Rachel Robinson. Somebody was asking Coleman in the 1985 season about Jackie Robinson, and he said, and I quote, "I don't know nothing about him. Why are you asking me about Jackie Robinson?" Of course, to the African-American community, and just not even 40 years after Robinson broke baseball's color barrier, this was a massive slap in the face, and Rachel Robinson was none too pleased, and obviously a lot of other people weren't either. even though he had a very successful run in St. Louis, he was their stolen base leader through 1990 and was also part of the National League pennant winning team in 1987 that would lose to the Twins in seven games. Even though statistically he did well, he was just becoming a little bit of a headache for the team, and they opted to let him go in 1990, after the 1990 season, letting him go into free agency. So he signs a four-year deal with the Mets worth nearly $12 million. That was one of the highest contracts in Major League Baseball at the time, certainly in Mets history. And even though they thought that he would be part of kind of a quick rebuild of the Mets, as the Mets were starting to slide back not only from their world championship ways in 1986, but of course hindsight being 2020, you could see the Mets kind of losing their grip for good after the 1988 National League Series against the Dodgers. So the Mets think that they could just bring in this speedster and very quickly help him out here, but Coleman, again, clashing with managers, clashing with assistant coaches, complaining about the Shea Stadium turf. Of course, it was real grass, but not very good real grass. The Shea Stadium turf was one of the worst natural turf fields in the major leagues for many, many years. And there was always somebody else to blame for Vince Coleman's problems. He played the victim card extremely well. And he also played the card well when it came to the injury ward. He was injured often in his time with the Mets and very quickly was noted as a bust. In fact, the Mets tried to move him in 1993, but they found no takers. So finally, in 1994, the Mets were able to trade him to the Kansas City Royals with cash for Kevin McReynolds. Of course, McReynolds' career is pretty much coming to a close here. So this is one of those deals that sports teams make. Here, you take my problem child. Here's some money. Okay, I'll take this overage veteran off your roster. And, you know, two teams basically try to do some addition by subtraction, if you know what I mean. And Vince would go on to play one season with the Royals. Actually had 76 steals in 179 games. Not one season with the Royals. He played two seasons with the Royals, eventually getting traded to the Mariners in mid-1995, later bouncing around to the Reds and the Angels farm system. Another downside to his time with the Mets, he was involved in a very serious incident with other Mets players in Los Angeles in 1992, where he threw a firecracker near a crowd of autograph seekers. And while he was in a vehicle that sped away from the incident, claiming later to know nothing about what was going on, the firecracker actually injured several fans, including a two-year-old, who suffered some major injuries. And he had to deal with the wrath of fans afterwards and the law. He was actually sentenced to 200 hours of community service, and the Mets suspended him for the remainder of the season. This was back in 1993. And, you know, this was really kind of the last straw. You know, a lot of people kind of put up with Vince Coleman for many years, and then finally this was it. And like I said, the Mets were trying to shop him, and obviously he was damaged goods. Nobody wanted him. And as Brad Blukjan will even cover in the Wax Pack book, he mentions how, you know, the family of that two-year-old, Amanda Santos, thought that Coleman was going to pay for medical bills and some support in her recovery. And, you know, the best they ever got from him was some balloons and a teddy bear. You know, a nice sentimental gesture, but that doesn't really, you know, answer the medical bill call from a family, you know, a blue-collar family with a young child who has some major medical bills there. So how does Vince Coleman resurrect himself? Well, he never really did at first. He kind of went into seclusion for many, many years and eventually got into coaching. He was a roving coach teaching base running, first for the Chicago White Sox and later the San Francisco Giants. And if you read the Wax Pack book by Brad Blukjan, you'll also know that Vince Coleman is, now we'll just leave it at that. You've got to read that chapter because it is a very sad, sad chapter. Now let's go from sad to just kind of goofy here. And I don't have a lot of information about this gentleman except that he just has one of those great 1980s baseball names. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go between the sheets here. Larry Sheets, who was a designated hitter and outfielder for the Baltimore Orioles. His career would also take him to Detroit and Seattle, and then he also played in Japan. Yokohama was the team that he played for in 1992. An interesting note here from Larry Sheets. He attended Eastern Mennonite University, where he also starred in basketball. He was named to the Old Dominion Athletic Conference's All-Conference second team in baseball, and he was on the first team in 1982, graduating in 1984, and he is actually a Hall of Fame member of Eastern Mennonite's athletic department. He was given that title back in 1988. And not only having a great name, you know, Sheets, you could always go, holy Sheets, or, oh, the Sheets hits the fans here. All sorts of Sheets jokes going on. It's noted on his 1989 Donruss baseball card, he lived in Cockeysville, Maryland. So you have Sheets and Cockeys, which it's just a splendid combination when you are a youngster collecting sports cards at the time. Last check, he currently operates a youth sports facility in Maryland. He is also a varsity baseball coach at Gilman School, and his son Gavin is a member of the Chicago White Sox organization. So plenty of Sheets to go around. Got a bad case of the Sheets here. Now, the next two players are players who don't quite get the respect that they deserve. And I think part of it is the teams they played for, teams that had their moments in the sun in the mid-80s, were kind of competitive in the late 80s, but kind of fell out of favor. And of course, in the late 80s, you're looking at star players like Dwight Gooden and Darryl Strawberry and Roger Clemens and Canseco and McGuire. I mean, you know, the list of stars that were, you know, front and center back in those days. But there are some players who just kind of got overlooked. And it wasn't on purpose. It's just that's how it is. Sometimes it's the city you play in, the team that you play for. Maybe it doesn't generate a lot of excitement or notice. But I definitely want to give their due. One is a pitcher. The other is an infielder. And I don't want to call him a utility infielder because he was good at both first and third base, primarily with the Kansas City Royals, talking about Kevin Seitzer. Now, Seitzer is one of those players who was pretty good but not great. He did a lot of things well, but he wasn't known as a star player. But when you look at his statistics, especially in his time in Kansas City, you have to wonder how he's been overlooked by the baseball population for so many years. And the only answer I can think of is when he starred in Kansas City, it was when the Royals were good but not great in the late 80s and early 90s. And also, he kind of had the makeup of a player like David Eckstein. David Eckstein's the greatest example I can think of. You know, somebody who did a lot of things really good, but, you know, was never noted as a great player. But if you ask his teammates, he was an outstanding cog in the machine. He was, you know, a good leader, was a good team player. And David Eckstein is, you know, definitely the epitome of that. And I think Kevin Seitzer kind of falls into that position as well. From Springfield, Illinois, he attended Eastern Illinois University and was drafted by the Royals in the 1983 draft in the 11th round. Talk about a quick riser through the Royals system. He would make his major league debut in 1986 and became a regular for the Royals in 1987. Now, he started at first base, but eventually moved over to third base when the Royals decided to move George Brett to first. Of course, Brett, starting to age at this point in time, was susceptible to injuries, so if you park him at first, it's a little safer for him. And Brett could still hit the cover off the ball, so you want to keep him as healthy as possible. Well, it didn't affect Seitzer in any stretch of the imagination. In 1987, he actually hit .323, also had 15 home runs. A lot of people don't know him for the power that he had, and he actually did have a little bit, which is saying a lot, too, considering the spacious confines of what is now Kauffman Stadium, formerly Royal Stadium. It's not easy to hit home runs in that ballpark, yet Seitzer managed to do that quite often. He also had 207 hits, tying the Major League Baseball record in his rookie season, and he was an American League All-Star member in 1987 as well. And, you know, for a team that had George Brett, and of course, you had Bo Jackson as well, it's easy to see why even an All-Star nomination in your rookie season can get overlooked, which was rather unfortunate for Seitzer, considering the career that he was able to put together. Now, his best times was with Kansas City, where he played through 1991. However, the Royals started shedding payroll and started moving players around. And they actually released Seitzer during spring training in 1992. He very quickly signed on with the Milwaukee Brewers. He became their starting third baseman, and after becoming a free agent once again in 1993, he would sign with Oakland. But his career was starting to wind down. He was actually released by the team after the All-Star break that season. He really struggled at the plate, later re-signed with Milwaukee, again as an everyday player, was able to revive his career, was an All-Star in 1995, and you could argue, despite his incredible 1987 season, his 1996 season, which he split between Milwaukee and Cleveland, could have been his best. He had a .326 batting average, 13 home runs, 78 RBI as well, an on-base percentage of .416, a career best. Now, he would also appear in the postseason with the Indians in 1996 and 1997, coming just shy of winning a World Series. Of course, the Indians falling to the Marlins in seven games. Now, after his playing career, he would go on to the coaching ranks as well, later becoming a hitting coach, first with the Arizona Diamondbacks, also the Kansas City Royals, and he is now in that, I should also say he was with the Toronto Blue Jays briefly, and he's been in that position with the Atlanta Braves since 2014. Now, even though Kevin Seitzer doesn't jump out at you, despite a pretty solid career, you know, a .295 career batting average, 74 home runs, 613 RBI, stretched out over a 12-year major league career, he does have a lasting gift to the game. Seitzer was one of the first players to use a C-flap on his helmet. Now, there have been various versions of helmet additions to protect broken jaws. Of course, Dave Parker, one of the most popular, most famous ones, where he wore, you know, half a football helmet and half a hockey goalie mask while he was recovering from facial injuries in the mid-70s. But Seitzer, protecting a formerly broken jaw, wore the C-flap on his helmet, and now the C-flap is practically on every Major League Baseball player's helmet, and you're even seeing it in Little League as well. So Seitzer didn't wear it long, but he wore it well, and that is a lasting image for Seitzer. Again, still a current hitting instructor, or batting coach, I should say, but also, you know, was able to add to the legacy of certain uniform pieces over the years. Last but not least, a guy who, again, doesn't quite get the respect that he deserves. And just like Seitzer with the Royals, it's because the teams he was on had some good years, didn't win any World Series. You know, Seitzer came on with the Royals after their 85 championship. And Mike Scott had kind of the same outcome, unfortunately, and it kind of overshadows what was a very productive career for him. Born in Santa Monica, California in 1955, Scott would go to Hawthorne High School after being a star in Little League. In fact, you could argue that the bigger star of Little League was his dad, who was an outstanding Little League coach. In fact, Mike Scott's dad and mom received the George and Barbara Bush Little League Parents of the Year Award in 1990. So even as Mike Scott was starring with the Houston Astros at that point in time, his parents were picking up some hardware as well. He had some outstanding seasons at Hawthorne High School. As a senior, he was 9-1 with a .67 earned run average. He also hit four home runs, but mystifyingly was not drafted out of high school. He didn't have any scholarship offers as well. And just before he went on to junior college, he actually got a call from Pepperdine University. Wayne Wright, the head baseball coach at Pepperdine, was able to reach out to him. Of course, not that far from Scott's hometown of Santa Monica. So off to Pepperdine he goes, and he would star at Pepperdine. In fact, earned all conference honors in the West Coast Athletic Conference for three straight years, had a 26-14 record, 2.10 earned run average, and would set school records for wins, strikeouts, and innings pitched. Now, since then, those records have been broken, but clearly starting to get the attention of some major league teams. What also helps him get some attention? Throwing a perfect game in February 1976 against Cal Lutheran. He was also a star in international baseball competition, was part of a United States College All-Star team with some kid named Paul Molitor as part of that crew. Also on that team, Floyd Bannister, Ken Phelps, so some pretty notable names that you would see later in the late 70s and early 80s. Finally, he gets drafted by the big league club with all that success on his resume. The New York Mets draft him in the second round of the 1976 amateur draft while he was a junior at Pepperdine. And he was kind of surprised by the fact that the Mets drafted him. He didn't know that he was on their radar. Of course, scouting and communications for prospects, a lot different 40-plus years ago than it is nowadays. But starting in 1977, he goes to the minor leagues and quickly moves up through the Mets farm system. Now, it's not just because he is a fairly successful pitcher, but it's also because the Mets are just in the dregs of rebuilding in the late 1970s. And in fact, he finds his way as part of the Major League club roster in 1979. Not necessarily because of anything that he did, but because general manager Joe McDonald was not allowed to go shopping for a veteran reliever. So basically, Mike Scott made the big league roster by default. He was the last man on the 10-man pitching staff. And there you go. He's all of a sudden a major leaguer. But he was not ready for the major leagues. And in fact, midway through the 1979 season, goes back to AAA in Tidewater and would kind of bounce back and forth between AAA and the major leagues from 1979 to 1982. Now, he was getting frustrated. He needs just a change of scenery, and he gets that in December 1982. He's traded to the Houston Astros for outfielder Danny Heap. And even though Heap had a pretty decent major league career, you could argue that, yeah, the Astros came out on top with this deal. But it wasn't instant success. In 1983, Scott pitches all right. He goes 10-6 with a 3.72 earned run average, although he was dealing with some shoulder injuries, and started going backwards in 1984. And at this point in time, people are thinking that Mike Scott is a, you know, high draft pick bust, and he's, you know, very young at this stage in time, before his 30th birthday. People are thinking his career may be done. Well, he's thrown a line by teammate Enos Cabell. Now, Cabell was with the Detroit Tigers in 1983, and Cabell was talking about Roger Craig, who was the pitching coach of the Tigers, including their 1984 World Series championship season. Now, after the 84 season, Craig goes into semi-retirement mode. He just takes a break in 1985, and Cabell was talking to Scott about what Roger Craig had done with the Tigers pitching staff. Because if you look at the Tigers pitching staff in 1984, Jack Morris, Dan Petrie, Frank Tanana, Willie Hernandez, you had some really good pitchers. And yes, I know Jack Morris is in the Hall of Fame now, and deservedly so. But it's not like Jack Morris was the most dominant pitcher in the major leagues. Basically, Roger Craig took a pretty good, you know, pitching staff here and turned them into world champions. And Cabell was talking about how great Roger Craig was for this team. So with permission from the Astros, Scott was able to, through Cabell, get connected with Roger Craig, who was living in San Diego at the time. So for several days, he would meet with Craig and work on some of his pitching techniques. And this was kind of the turning point in Scott's career. Not only does he hear from a master in Roger Craig, but he also learns how to utilize the split finger fastball. Ironically, a tool that Jack Morris would use to not only extend his career, but pick up a couple more World Series with Minnesota and Toronto in the early 1990s. So as Scott is learning how to use this split finger fastball and how he can mix it into his repertoire, he had a good fastball, and he also had, you know, decent breaking stuff, but he just didn't have that dominant out pitch. Well, now he finally had it, and it showed. In 1985, he goes 18-8, 3.29 earned run average. The splitter is working. And despite the fact that many teams thought that Scott was getting success through doctoring the baseball, and they often accused Mike Scott of scuffing the ball, he never got caught. He never, you know, umpires checked the baseballs all the time, but there was never any evidence, hard evidence, that he did this. And of course, he still denies it to this day that he ever doctored the baseball. But there are plenty of other coaches and managers, including Roger Craig, later when he was managing San Francisco, who would accuse Scott of doctoring the ball, even though there's really no hard evidence that it ever happened. Scott's best season, 1986, when the Astros win the National League West title. He had an 18-10 record, a 2.2 earned run average, 2.22 earned run average, 306 strikeouts, 5 shutouts, and rather famously helped the Astros clinch the division title on September 25th, 1986, with a no-hitter against Roger Craig and his Giants. Now, just a week later, in his next outing of the season, he flirted with fate. He almost matched Johnny Vandermeer's record of back-to-back no-hitters, as the Giants didn't pick up their first hit until a Will Clark double led off the seventh inning. And interestingly, the Astros would go on to win the game in the 10th inning. But that close to baseball infamy was Mike Scott. He had an outstanding National League Championship Series against the Mets. Although the Mets pulled out victoriously, Scott, one of the few NLCS MVPs who represented the losing team. And after that, it was kind of a dark shadow that hung over the Astros for a very long time. Of course, at this point in time, Scott is 33, and all those years of throwing the split-fingered fastball start wearing down on his arm. He did have some pretty successful seasons, 16-13 with a 3.23 earned run average in 87, 14-8 with a 2.92 earned run average in 88, was actually a candidate for the Cy Young Award, even though he didn't receive much consideration. He was overpowered again by some of these fastball pitchers, you know, the Goodens and the Clemens and, you know, those types of the world. And even though he continued to flirt with no-hitters, he had a couple of one-hitters late in his career and did win 20 games in 1989. The abuse of his shoulder just using that split-finger fastball finally caught up with the rest of his body, and he had a tear in his rotator cuff late in the 1989 season. Had a subpar, to say the least, 1990 season, was barely able to get out of the gate in 1991. And pretty much his career ended in the 1991 season. Ever since then, Scott is an avid golfer, a world traveler as well, and a legend with the Houston Astros. He is much loved and revered in Houston for all of his success and being able to be a big part of those powerful Astros teams in the mid-1980s. And if you think about, you know, you're 1-2, in the Astros rotation in 1986, Mike Scott and Nolan Ryan, just amazing. You know, it was kind of a spawn and sane and pray for rain situation, because the Astros didn't have a whole lot after that. I know Jim DeShays had some good years there, but, you know, Danny Darwin, it's kind of a drop off from Ryan and Scott. You know, he had a nice successful run there in the mid to late 80s. And, you know, I don't want to say I feel sorry, but I've always connected with a player like Mike Scott and even Kevin Seitzer to an extent. You know, I'm a big fan of, I don't want to say the underdog, but the lesser known. You know, I'm a big fan of George Harrison. He's my favorite Beatle. My favorite stooge, Shemp Howard, arguably the best actor of the whole family. When it comes to Hershey mini chocolate bars, I eat the Mr. Good bars. Nobody else will eat them, so somebody's got to eat them. And just like Mike Scott, you know, the Houston Astros, pretty good team in the mid to late 80s, never got up to a level of greatness. And you could argue that Scott was there as well. Boy, he had some really good years and was able to extend his career, albeit you could argue that he, you know, ended his career with a split-finger fastball, but was able to extend it a good 5 years and do some incredible things with it while drawing the ire of many National League managers with how he threw the ball. All right, that's our look at the 1988 Topps American Baseball set. You may call it UK Minis. The Irish in me says, no, sir, it's Topps American Baseball. It was made in the Republic of Ireland. It was made in County Cork It is not United Kingdom. Let's get that set. 1988, American Tops Baseball, also produced in 1989. Both sets worthy of you spending 10 or 15 bucks on. Very nice, small sets, very fun, educational information on the backs of the cards, and just a well-designed set for all the right reasons. It just, again, because not everything translates well internationally. And even though Europe was a leader in, you know, commercialism and capitalism and, democracy emerging in the late 80s and early 90s, Topps had to take care of business at home. It had to go back stateside, where it had a pretty big battle to fight with the competing companies, and they decided to leave Europe aside come the 1990s. Well, that'll do it for our look at the Topps American Baseball card sets. Again, upcoming, an interview with Brad Blukjan, the author of the Wax Pack book that will be coming soon. We plan on having that program on July 17th. Shortly thereafter, we'll take a look at the classic and the delightfully tacky 1975 Topps set. And we'll also dive into the rather unpopular, but it still served a good purpose, and you can buy it probably for about 50 cents these days, the 1982 Topps Kmart 20th anniversary set. Don't know, again, if that'll follow the 75 Topps show, but it is something we will get to one of these days. Again, if you would like to make a cash donation, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Cardboard donations, welcome to. Please email me at mattsalmonsays@gmail.com, or you can just send a DM on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline. Until then, until next time, wash your hands, wear your mask, social distance, have a safe 4th of July weekend, stay safe, stay healthy, listen to the experts, don't rush out for that bucket of Bud Lights at your local bar. It's just not safe to do it right now, okay? Be smart. Come on now. Be smart. And take care of yourself. Take care of others. And if you want to watch football this fall, wash your hands, wear your mask, and social distance. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and thanks for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.